Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f***? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
The Drive Nation Podcast with Dan Prosser and Andrew Frankel.
We're splitting episode 47 of the Drive Nation Podcast down the middle. Later on, we're going to talk about rallying and why it's unquestionably the finest form of motorsport that there is. But Andrew's shaking his head. But before we do that, we're going to talk about the new 911 GT3. And that's the reason that we've had to hold on to this podcast for a few more hours. We've had to wait for the embargo to lift. And actually, we're recording this on the Friday morning before the embargo lifts. And so, while we've got the technical information, Andrew, we haven't yet seen the car. So,
no.
I don't know. Should we speculate a bit? It's a shame it's a four-door these days, isn't it? But
yeah, well,
I suppose you have to keep it fresh.
SUV, whatever. We haven't seen the car, but I mean, I can't imagine we're going to be terribly surprised.
No.
It probably looks like an 911 with a wing, doesn't it? It's going to look like a GT3.
Okay. So this is the seventh 911 GT3.
Wow.
And the first one came out around 21 years ago. So we get a new GT3 every 3 years. Not quite Halley's Comet, is it really? But a sort of significant moment nonetheless. And frankly, if you're doing a weekly podcast, you have to make the most of these occasions, don't you? So we're going to talk about it in some detail. The thing about the GT3 that always gets me is that they'll launch a new one and it's always Andreas Preuninger. I will talk you through all the fine details that they've made, all the refinements that they've made to this latest one to make it more powerful, to make it faster. And every single time he does that, you think, wow, how on earth are you going to, you know, take it to the next level beyond this one? What is there left to do? And with this one, we know, don't we? Because it's got that new swan-style rear wing. But also, it's got double wishbone front suspension rather than a McPherson strut, the first 911 to have that. So it's as though 911 GT3 development got to a point where they'd maximised everything that they had available to them. And they had to take a big quantum step forward just to find that next, you know, that next bit of ground.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting, isn't it? One of the things that also interests me about it is that despite the fact that they are doing this stuff, they are finding areas in which to gain that ground. What they're not doing is compromising the principle. I mean, clearly, there are turbocharged GT cars. They're called GT2s. But you would have thought, wouldn't you, that with turbochargers on all standard 911s now, and this being the performance one, that it would be logical for this one to be a turbocharged car, but it's not. And it interests me because it kind of bucks the trend, doesn't it, of the sort of more that, you know, that every generation of car has to be substantially more powerful than the previous one. I mean, this car is 10 horsepower more than the last one. I mean, it really is. It's nothing. It's nothing at all. It's 2%. And they just seem to be much more interested in refining the details and concentrating on the driving experience rather than going after customers who will only buy a car if it's got 1,000 horsepower and, you know, and this, that, and the other. They just, they build cars for people who like to drive, not for cars for people who like to boast about statistics in, you know, in pub saloon bars or whatever. And that I guess is what I've always liked about these cars, is that they have, you know, that very technical stuff that you're talking about is to me the root of their appeal. And that to me is so much more engaging and talks to me as a driver so much more than, oh, look, it's got another 100 horsepower. I'm just not bothered by that. You know, it's enough.
Before we go any further, do you like my new camera angle? If you're watching on YouTube, you'll see I'm sitting somewhere else in my flat. A few people commented that my wall looked very naked behind me. So I've got a new camera angle, a less comfortable seat, but my lovely poster of the
things you do for your audience. You're such a giver.
1971. Very generous, aren't we? Okay, so let's run through some of the technical details on the new Porsche 911 GT3. As you said, still a 4-litre, normally aspirated boxer, 6-cylinder, 510 PS. So that's 503 brake horsepower, isn't it? More sophisticated aerodynamics. We've mentioned the double wishbone front axle. Now, still, you have the option of a PDK or a manual gearbox. Now, here's a reason to have the manual. With a stick and a third pedal, it'll do 199 miles per hour. But with PDK, a mere 198.
Oh, well, then, I mean, that's all you need, isn't it? Well, I'll tell you one thing is quite interesting, is the manual is now, I think this is right, only 17 kilograms lighter than the PDK. Now, PDKs are the heaviest form of transmission you can get. They're heavier than conventional autos. It's one of the reasons manufacturers used to quote for not having them, usually as an excuse, because actually the other thing about PDKs is they're terribly expensive. But now, I mean, 18K, I mean, you know, I would just have one manual. I mean, I just, you know, of all cars, to me, a GT3 should be manual. Even so, there isn't that big weight hit. And the power's interesting, isn't it? Because it's like it now completely splits the difference between the old GT3 and the last GT3 RS. So the old GT3, I think, was 500 PS. The GT3 RS was 520, and this is 510. So it's kind of going straight down the middle, isn't it?
Yeah.
But yeah. It's still...
And it's plenty, as you say.
It is plenty. And the other thing is, you know, this is basically, and I really do mean this, it's the racing car engine. It's the engine. You know, if you go and race in Carrera Cup in your cup car, that's the engine. I mean, it has changed remarkably little. I would think that all the internals are the same as the race car. And it is such, wow, it is such an engine. It is so, the way that it delivers what it does, kind of hardwired straight into your soul. You know, it's grounds for having the car all by itself, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, that's often been the way with GT3 engines, isn't it? But this... Yeah, these latest ones, the post-Mexico ones, they're still spectacular things. Really the heart of the car. And as you say, reason enough to long to own one of those cars. They just make the whole driving experience. And you step out of one. This is what I always think when I get out of any car, really, that's got a soaring, normally aspirated engine like that. I just think, I don't ever want to drive a turbo car again.
Yeah, you know? I know exactly what you mean.
You don't miss that torque hit, do you? You just, the way it lives on revs, the way, feeling it pull through a ratio, a really high revving engine, it's just, it's intoxicating.
Yeah, and it's, you know, and it's more than fast enough. More than.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Porsche says, go on, keep going.
I was going to say, by my calculations, it's 5 kilograms heavier than the last one, which doesn't strike me as being very much. Obviously, 10 horsepower more powerful. It's got an identical 0-62 time, 3.4 seconds. Again, it just interests me. You know, you'd think that, you know, any other manufacturer would want to claim that it's faster than the last one, but Porsche don't seem to be the least bit bothered by that. Can we talk Nürburgring lap times?
It's unavoidable, isn't it, really? Before you do, though, Porsche says it generates significantly higher levels of downforce without noticeably affecting the drag coefficient, which is interesting. But go on, get on to Nürburgring lap times.
Just on the downforce, I'm always suspicious of car manufacturers who play that card. Significantly, well, put some numbers on it. If it's significant, tell us what it is. Because significant is so subjective. Yeah. Significant to who? to you, to me, to them.
It could just mean measurable. It could be a few kilos,
exactly. You know, a kilo could be described as something. And so, I mean, maybe it does. But you would have thought that if they had done really, really impressive numbers, why wouldn't you say what they are?
Good point.
And I don't know. I mean, things are, and this is like kind of, you know, this is the journalist in me coming out and just thinking that that's just something which, I don't know. I just wish, you know, if you're going to say something like that, back it up with some facts. Because if you don't, people like me will always think you haven't got the facts to back it up. Now, I mean, I'm not in any way suggesting that this car has got, you know, miserable levels of downforce or anything else. I'm sure it's pretty good. I just think it would be so much more impressive if they actually told us what it was. And if you asked Porsche, how much downforce does this car have? Well, we will. I'd be interested to see if you even get an answer out of them. Maybe you will, maybe you won't.
But do you, I mean, we're pretty sceptical about downforce in road cars anyway. Is it a concern that they are, you know, they're not putting a number on it, but they're talking about higher levels of downforce? That has never made a car better to drive on the road, ever.
Not on the road, no, you're absolutely right. But this is a track car. And I'll tell you where downforce does work with these sorts of cars. It's just stability. I drove a Manti Racing GT3 RS at Silverstone not that long ago, which has got a lot of aero work on it. And what the aero did on that car, I've no idea what the downforce number was. It just made it easier to drive, which meant you could have more confidence, which meant you enjoyed driving the car more. So to that extent, to me, downforce does work on a car which has a track brief. There's no point in using downforce on the road, because if you're going right through corners fast enough for downforce to be an issue on a public road, then you shouldn't be driving a car like that. But on a car like this, and Porsche will tell you that most of its owners will take their car on a track at one time or another, even GT3s, let alone GT3 RSs. If you can just get that high-speed stability, which really allows you to commit, then I think it is doing a useful job. I couldn't care less what it does in terms of, you know, G-force and that sort of thing. Not interested.
No. Okay, well, it must be that extra downforce, whatever the number is, that helps with that Nürburgring lap time. So go on. What do you make of that?
So which lap time? So they quote two, don't they? They quote, what is it? 6:55.2 for the, that's the Bridge de Gantry, isn't it? That's the 20.4K. lap.
No, that it actually just cuts out the, it's called the T13 straight. It's like a 200 meter stretch of tarmac. There are two ways of measuring a full Nürburgring lap time, and it depends where you cut the beam, basically right at the end of the lap.
Okay.
Because it's only four seconds different.
So the two times they quoted 6:55.2 for the 20.4k circuit and 6:59.9 for the full 20.8 kilometre circuit. They must have been very pleased with the stopwatch went on that one. I don't know how they measured the last one, but the last one did a 7:12.7. Yeah? So at the very best, it is, this new car is going, what, nearly 13 seconds a lap faster. If you take it by the other measure, then that's whatever it is, 17, 18 seconds a lap faster, which is, even around the Nürburgring, that's a lot of time, isn't it? For a car which has hardly any more power and, weighs 5 kilograms more. So where is that time coming from? Do you think it's coming from aero? Do you think it's coming from the front suspension? Or do you perhaps think it's coming from the fact that last time the car was on Cup 2s and this time it was on Cup 2 R's?
Tricky one. we've spoken about this before, haven't we?
Yes. Those chocolate tyres.
Those Michelin Pilot Sport Cup 2R, they're made of chewing gum, aren't they?
Yeah.
It's an astonishing tyre to drive on.
Yeah.
And just an incredible tool for extracting lap times out of a car as well. So, I mean, we're right to highlight that, aren't we?
I mean, for the avoidance of doubt, all three, I'm sure, will make a difference. But if you ask me, or indeed, if you ask Porsche, I'd be interested to hear the answer. But certainly, if you ask me what is likely to have been the greatest contributor to that really pretty stark increase in lap time, decrease in lap time, I'm going the tyres. I'm going the tyres all day long, aren't you?
Yeah, it's got to be most of it.
Yeah.
Do you remember, only, well, less than a decade ago, what, maybe 8 years ago? I can't remember, actually, when the 918 Spider and the McLaren P1 were dipping under 7 minutes around the Nürburgring. And now a 911 GT3 is a sub-7 car.
Not even a GT3 RS.
Yeah.
As normally aspirated. Okay, yeah. A GT3, you're saying bog standard is a relative term when it comes to GT3s, but even so, it is absolutely, I mean, sub-7 used to be the thing that people always used to talk about, isn't it? It was, you know, Ferrari didn't quote a time. In fact, McLaren didn't even for the P1, did they? All McLaren would say was that it would go sub-7. I don't think they ever said, I don't think they ever put a number on it. Ferrari didn't even go down that road. And these were the fastest, you know, this was like 2014, 2015. So, you know, not decades ago, 6, 7 years ago. And these cars, they were busting their asses to get under 7 minutes. And now here's a street GT3, which is going to do it.
Astonishing, isn't it?
It is, that it is P1, absolutely amazing.
That P1, so it's 2 or 3 seconds quicker. I mean, the track has perhaps evolved a bit since then. We know tyre technology has come a long way. But that P1 is a... probably weighs about the same, doesn't it, as a 911 GT3, which is 1,418 kilograms with a manual gearbox.
Yeah, but they'd have done the time in a PDK, wouldn't they? So 1435.
They will have done 1435. Yeah. So, but the P1's got getting on for double the power. It's about 900 and something, isn't it? The P1, and it's got 600 kilograms of downforce, much more than the GT3.
Yeah,
and that equates to 2 or 3 seconds around the longest track on Earth.
Yeah, it's a 2-seat car that was only ever conceived to go as fast as it could possibly go. Whereas a 911 is a daily driver. A GT3 is a daily driver, no question at all. I know people who use, as do you, their GT3s as daily drivers. I mean, fair play to them. It is amazing. It is absolutely amazing.
Priced in the UK from £123,100.
It's a lot, isn't it?
Yeah. Do you remember when they were 80 grand? That was probably 10 years ago now, wasn't it? A GT3 was 80
grand. Yeah, I mean, the last one, I looked up the last one. I think it was, 111,802 is the number I've got written down here.
Okay.
So it's gone up 12 grand, which is, well, more than 10%, isn't it?
But they could charge 150 for those, couldn't they?
They could. And the other thing is that, you know, you were talking about when you get out of those GT3s and how you make them fit. I mean, when I get out of those GT3s, what I think to myself is that, you know, it sits at a level. And then above that level, there are what we call conventional supercars from very limited volume manufacturers with a lot more power and, you know, mid-engine two-seaters and whatever. And you get out of a GT3 and you think, well, actually... What are those other cars actually buying you? Are they really that much faster? Are they any more fun to drive? And clearly they're much more expensive. Clearly you can use them in fewer numbers of ways. And I get out of those GT3s and I just think that for what I want a car to do, they're just there. And, you know, obviously we must reserve judgment about this car, and it's possible they've made a complete Horlicks of it, and we get out of it and thinking, what do they think they're playing? I kind of doubt that's going to happen. I expect it's going to be amazing, but I just think, you know, that is the way that people should be thinking, because I think the power level is about right, and they should be thinking about getting weight out of the car and just making these things better to drive.
I find it interesting, you're absolutely right, that no one really has come along with a direct competitor to this car and followed the same technical blueprint, offering a manual, not ramping up power with every iteration.
Yeah.
Just staying true to those original principles.
I mean, there have been some sort of attempts at, I mean, something like a V12 Vantage Aston. That's kind of going down that sort of route. And I guess Mercedes would be jumping up and down and go, hang on, what about us? What about the GTR AMG and that sort of thing? But they're just not quite there, are they? I mean, the V12 Vantage S is just a wonderful car, and it connects with me emotionally. But you know, give me a lap and a racetrack, I'd just get in the GT3 because, you know, it would just be better, wouldn't it? And the same is true of the GTR. I mean, the GT3 is just a better, lighter, more engaging, more capable car. And so, you know, I think the reason there have, as you say, been so few people to have a go at it is because it must just be so hard.
Mm.
You know, how do you do it?
Maybe you're really setting yourself up for a fall. Yeah,
maybe one day Ferrari will do a Dino or McLaren will bring something in below the price point of the new Artura, which I really shouldn't say with an Italian accent, should I? But I'm not holding my breath because I don't think that they think that's where their business is. And I kind of understand that. So no, I think for now, Porsche got the field to itself.
So what are you hoping for from this new GT3? Just more of the same? Or do you want it to do something that earlier ones haven't done before?
I just want it to be better at the stuff those cars have always been good at. I can't really see how the powertrain can get any better. I love the usability of those cars. That's why I'm sure, I don't know this, but I'm sure there will be a touring version coming along. I can't see why they wouldn't. Those cars are so revered now. Their residuals are so good. And to me, of all those cars, be they GT3s, GT3 RSs, GT2 RSs, whatever, it's that touring which to me is the sweet spot, because it seems to me you don't lose very much. But the visual subtlety of it, and just that slight extra veneer of civility in it, it doesn't affect my enjoyment of the car when I'm driving it like an idiot. But just to be able to go about your business so discreetly in what to the outside world looks to, like to anybody, like just another 911. I mean, if I had one, I'd have it in a dark colour, I'd take all the badges off it, and I would just love it and keep it forever. So I just hope that, you know, I am confident that the car will be as good, if not better, to drive than any previous GT3. And so I would just like it to be even easier to live with too. So, you know, the head and the heart are even more catered for. But, you know, I'm not complaining about the last one. It's a wonderful thing. But, yeah, that's what I would do. What about you?
Well, I've just been wondering about what they might do with it to try and move the game along. And I think it would be a mistake, wouldn't it, to make the car tougher, harder riding in that pursuit of more performance. It would be a mistake if it was less usable, if it was more raw, more of a pain in the neck in normal driving than the
previous
one.
But that's what a GT3 RS is for, isn't it?
Exactly right, yeah. Yeah.
And actually,
yeah, let that car.
I thought the previous, as in the most recent GT3 RS, was in danger of going a little bit too far down that road, because it's very raw. And it is compromised on the road. I mean, it's mega on the track. But even on the track, and I do quite like this about it, and this is where it contrasted quite starkly with the Manti racing car, it's quite tricky. You do kind of need to have your wits about you on a track in a GT3 RS. It is set up to be a little bit spiky. I mean, it's not vicious or anything else, but you need to be on your toes. You can't just take it for granted that it's always going to come back and that you can be a bit sort of slack with it or whatever. You just need to be on it a bit. And I don't mind that on the track, but on the road, and the GT3 RS is still a road car, I just found it was just a bit too... I think didn't they double the spring rate on that car over the previous one, or it was up 50% or something. And I think that just went too far for that car's purpose. But you know, these things are all subjective, and that's just my view. But the GT3, I think, was pretty spot on, to be honest with you.
Mm. Yeah, that's the danger, isn't it? It's so right that I get the sense from car manufacturers that often they can't bear to stand still, and unless they can show on a spreadsheet where gains have been made, car won't make its way out the door.
But also, the customer doesn't want to be buying an old car, does he or she? That's the thing, isn't it? You know, they could have left the old GT3 in production, but then, you know, the market would get saturated with cars. The people were thinking, do I really want to buy a car that's been in the marketplace for 4 years? Probably not. And they'd just be storing up all sorts of trouble for themselves. And so that they do, although you know, Porsche obviously don't say how many they build, just by the length of time it's in production. They do keep numbers down. They do keep on top of the residuals. But, I mean, you know, if you went and drove a GT3 Touring now, I don't think you'd be getting out of that and thinking, oh, my goodness, this car needs replacing. No, I think sure you'd get out of it and you still think, frankly, there's nothing for this money that I'd rather have. And I think probably the big change, I think, you know, in 80% of the driving that 80% of the people will do will be the stuff that's actually common to other 992s. It'll be, you know, it'll be the connectivity and it'll be the nav system and it'll be the TFT readouts and all that sort of thing, all of which will make the car feel a lot more sophisticated. Yeah.
Well, we'll drive it soon enough and we'll find out. But I just hope that as they chase more and more performance and more grip, which is actually what the double wishbone front axle is all about, they haven't forgotten that these cars are supposed to be engaging and rewarding at not completely bonkers speeds on the public highway. So, I don't know. We'll find out, I suppose. Right, let's leave the 911 GT3 there. We're going to talk about rallying.
No, you're going to talk about rallying because I know nothing about rallying.
Well, that's fine. I want to sort of investigate that a little bit. Just give us 20 seconds on your view on rallying. And, of course, it's such a huge spectrum. But, yeah. I mean, is it on your radar? Do you ever go out and watch them? Are you interested? What do you think?
My view on rallying is there is a theory and there is a reality. In theory, I should love rallying. I think it is one of the very last remaining truly heroic forms of motorsport. You know, I look at those guys going down those gravel tracks with all the countryside and scenery and things that they could hit around them at those sorts of speeds, and I am absolute awe of them. You know, I've sat next to one or two of them, and they do things with cars I didn't know that anyone could do with cars, let alone someone like me. There have been some rally cars that I have absolutely adored. I mean, you know, 037 Lanciers and, you know, stuff like that. Some of the most viscerally exciting competition cars of any kind that there have ever been. You know, so there have been some unbelievable rally drivers. And in theory, I should just be obsessed with it. But I'm not. And I have thought, knowing that this podcast was coming up, I have thought about why that is. And I think that part of it is that it's all against the clock. And, you know, you measure your performance against the next man or woman's performance on a stopwatch, not by trying to post one up the inside into... And that is a huge component. You know, when I watch a Grand Prix, frankly, I'm only interested in the overtaking. I'm not interested in watching Lewis break a lap record. I'm not interested in watching anybody drive around a track fast. I'm interested in man against man, a machine against machine, you know, millimetres apart, 200 miles an hour, all fighting for the same piece of tarmac. That's what floats my boat in Formula One and all other forms of track-based motorsport. And it is the one thing you don't get in rallying. So it's not that I thought to myself, well, I don't like rallying because of that. It's because I have sat down and thought, well, why aren't I a huge rally fan? And looking through it, I can only really identify that as a reason. But I don't know. I mean, maybe it was one of those things. It's one of those things that what I should do is I should just make a concerted effort over the course of a season to really, really get it. Watch every rally and actually go out and watch some local stuff. Maybe even do a rally. I would quite like to do that.
That's a good idea.
And then maybe I would suddenly... It's not that I don't get it. I do get it. I get rallying completely. It just somehow feels not for me. Whereas for you, it is far more exciting and interesting and fun and wonderful than Formula One or perhaps any other kind of circuit racing, isn't it?
Well, I don't know, actually. I do love it. I'm not sure I'd necessarily take it over any other form of motorsport. I think in preparing for this, you suggested I'd far rather watch a rally than... be in Monaco for the Grand Prix. And I actually, that's not quite right. I'd like to be able to do both.
Yeah, but the way I put it to you was Monaco or Monte Carlo, and you can only do one.
Well, I can't really. I've never watched the Grand Prix, so I'd do that, but I don't know. Honestly, I can't really split them. I love them both because you're right. It's the wheel-to-wheel racing that makes F1 and other forms of circuit racing so exciting. The trouble with rallying, and there are a few issues. One, it's difficult to follow. You know, I don't even know where I can watch rounds of the World Championship on TV.
Yeah.
It's always somewhere different year to year, it seems. So it's difficult to get into a rhythm of watching everyone. Whereas a Grand Prix, I know when it's on, I know where I can watch it. It takes 2 hours out of my weekend and then it's done.
Yeah.
And so I have my frustrations with rallying, and it's even more so when you try and watch one of the buggers, because, do you know, in the past, I've been so irritated with rally organisers for allowing their events to be so difficult to spectate on. You, for the most part, you really have to get stuck in there with an OS map and trace these tiny little footpaths from one point to another and work out where you're going to park, how long it's going to take to walk from here to here. And I understand that's the nature of the beast, because rallies are rallies, but I just think it needs to be modernised so that it's far easier just to turn up somewhere, follow your phone, go here, stand, and then you're on a rally stage watching rallying.
Yeah.
I think they have done a bit
of that, haven't they? With sort of, you know, special stages around stately homes and that sort of
thing.
But it all sort of feels a bit artificial. I can remember coming to watch you when you were sharing with our friend Chris Harris.
You didn't have to go far.
It was a E30 325i.
Yeah.
And you were navigating it. Chris was driving it. And this was in the Wydeen Rally.
Yeah.
Which sadly isn't happening at the moment. But it's a rally that's local to where I live in the Wye Valley. And I did exactly what you suggested. I just went off blundering through the woods. And eventually I came across a sort of scattering of people. And I just ended up standing there for a very long time, getting extremely cold. And then occasionally a Vauxhall Nova or something like that would come futting past. And I don't know, there was a long time spent getting cold for not much time watching rally cars. And I think actually by that stage, I think you guys had actually broken. So I don't think I ever even got to see you guys come past. So it was a complete waste of time. There were some interesting bits. There were some guys who came through, you know, fully lit, properly committed. And that was genuinely exciting. But I was quite scared too, not for myself, because I'm not a complete idiot, but there are clearly some people who watch rallying who are complete idiots. And they stand in really stupid places. And I was scared for them because I've got an imagination, and I'm just, you know, standing there thinking, if that car has brake failure now, or if he hits a tree stump, which takes a wheel off, or just causes him to lose control, or the navigator's read out a wrong pace note, or he just gets a bit of brain fade because he's a bit tired, or he had a row with the missus last night. You know, that bloke standing on the outside of that corner has no chance whatsoever. And, you know, there's a part of me which thinks, well, that's all very intrepid and that's kind of quite old school. But there's more of me which just thinks it's unnecessary.
Yeah, I mean, I understand what you're saying about when people stand in stupid places. Yeah, it does ruin your enjoyment of it, because you just think, well, if a car goes off there, I've witnessed something terrible and I don't want that to happen. But, I mean, we have to distinguish between the Wydeen Rally, great event though it is, and a proper world championship round. And the thing about spectating on a rally, apart from the fact that it's difficult, and it really takes a lot of effort and a lot of input to get it right, and a lot of time, you can have such varying experiences depending purely on where you stand and which section of stage you're on. Okay, I've got a good example of this. A few years ago, when I was following rallying quite closely, I was going to a lot of the World Championship rounds. I did Rally Finland. I've only done it once. Wow. And I was really excited because it's perhaps the most spectacular they do call it the Gravel Grand Prix, but the most spectacular rally to watch, at least the footage that I'd seen. The stages are so fast. There's enormous jumps. I mean, it looks astonishing. I was really looking forward to this. And the first stage we turned up to was we were positioned on a tight hairpin. We're probably 100, 150 metres away from the cars. And you saw them for each car for 10 seconds. They'd come around the corner, slow down, round a hairpin, and then power off and disappear again. And I just thought, actually, this is no spectacle whatsoever, and I would rather not be here watching this. And then later in the day, we went elsewhere, where the cars were quite literally flying past us. And it was the most astonishing thing I've witnessed in of any form of motorsport. Yeah. So it can vary greatly. I suppose that's true with Formula One, isn't it? If you're sat by a slow corner, it's okay. But if you're sat somewhere where there's overtaking action and
I think it's much more so in rallying.
I think it is, yeah.
I really do. And maybe that's part of the issue. Maybe as a spectator, you know, you can, as long as you're rich enough, and goodness knows you do have to be rich these days, but you can just buy a ticket to Silverstone and go and sit in the grandstand, and it's all just easy, isn't it? Indulging your passion for rallying isn't easy, is it?
No.
Probably the greatest rally fan I ever knew as a friend was the late Russell Bulgin, that extraordinary writer, who very sadly died a long time ago now. But anyway, he was a complete rally nut. And, you know, he would go anywhere at really, really unusual times in the morning just to get the best vantage point. And he knew where all the great places were in all the great rally stages all over the UK, be they in Wales or up in the Lake District or wherever. And he would take everything with him, all his food, all his coffee, he'd take a somewhere to sit. And he'd just sit down and that would be him. He would just be happy as Larry for the rest of the day, and he'd just sit there and he'd just watch cars coming past. And for him, that was you know, his passion. And if it is, that's great. But it's such a commitment, isn't it? Both in terms of knowledge and in time, and frankly, in terms, I was about to say personal suffering. Maybe that's somewhat overdoing it. But you know, you are going to be out in some pretty inclement weather, aren't you? For very long periods of time. And you really do have to absolutely love it to want to do that. Whereas to go and watch, well, anything from a Formula One race to a little clubby. You know, if I want to go watch a little clubby, I'll go half an hour down the road and I'm at Castle Coombe of a weekend. It'll cost me nothing to get in. And I can just watch, you know, cars going around the circuit. It's really terribly easy to indulge my passion, you know, as a spectator. And so maybe that's also part of the problem, is that there is no middle ground. It's not like, you know, you're either going to be absolutely committed to it and love it, or it's very difficult to maintain a sort of armchair enthusiast interest for it, isn't it?
Okay, let me describe my last visit to Wales Rally GB to you. And at some point, you're going to think, actually, that sounds quite fun. Okay, so it was 2019. This is when the rally was in October, not right at the end of the year. So it was only a little bit chilly. It wasn't freezing. I think it's probably about 4 a.m. that Chris Harris pulled up outside my flat in a Panamera that he'd blagged for the weekend.
Yeah, that's what most people go rallying, isn't it? But most people actually, when they go to watch it, they go Panamera. Panameras that they blagged from Porsche.
Okay, so we were quite privileged. And then we went around the corner, picked up my other mate, and then, so the three of us packed off in this Panamera across the bridge with a boot full of bacon and bread rolls and sausages and crisps. And we had a couple of barbecues. We met up with another car with three more mates in it. And we set off through Mid Wales up to Rhyadr, and then had a good drive up there, and then pulled off onto a gravel track. And by that time, it's probably 7 a.m. or something. And then we parked up about a mile from the stage, and we got the barbecue going, had some teas and coffees and bacon rolls and sausages. And then we wandered up to the stage, watched the first lot through, and that was brilliant fun because we had a good spot. Then we wandered back down, had another barbecue, bit more food, lots of laughs. A little bit later on, we went back up the hill to a new spot, watched the cars come through again, and then we piled off home and went to the pub. It was you, when you make
it's
when
a good
you
day
really
out.
Commit to
it's
it
a good
when
day
you really
out.
Commit to it, yeah, It can be fantastic.
Okay, so that's a proper commitment, but it's involving your mates. And okay, I will make this commitment. If next time you do that, and if you want to, ask me along, and I will come along, and I will give it my best shot.
Okay.
It does sound like fun doing it that way with your buddies and with a barbecue. But it's all about, isn't it? It's all about the prep. Clearly, it's all.
Yeah, you've got to be ready.
Having the right clothing, having the right food, having the right transport, having the right mates, knowing where to go. It's all about the prep. And if you mess up any one of those, you might not have such a great day. But I will do it. I would like, because I am genuinely interested in why I'm not interested. And I would like that passion to be sparked. And I would like to, what I would really like to do, I thought this would happen actually to me when Colin Goodwin took me to the Isle of Man for the TT. And I want to do that as a separate podcast, so I'm not going to talk about it a lot. But actually, that was too much for me. I came away with that with my head so completely and utterly blown, in ways that were bad as well as good. I haven't been back. But what I want with rallying is to go up there and have that experience that you had with my buddies, with the right gear, and come away thinking, this is now on the calendar. I'm going to do this every single year for as long as it, because it's just a day out which you have to have. That would make me very happy.
Okay, I just want to flesh this out a little bit. Why rallying is so good. For people who have never really followed it or given it much attention, the fundamentals of it, we need to discuss a little bit now, because it's a multifaceted form. There are so many elements that make it really interesting, to me at least. Okay, there's, even the pace notes, the fact that the drivers are operating with a co-driver, and there's that whole relationship between them, and that understanding and that sense of rhythm and timing between them. It's fundamental to the sport, right? There's the fact that you're interacting with the scenery, that it takes place often in very, very beautiful landscapes. And so the images and the footage that you get from these events is spellbinding to look at. There's the fact that the rallies are shorter now, but they're still very long days, 3 or 4 days in a row. And I think it is an exhausting thing to do. So there's a sense of endurance about it. Some of the stages are really long, and the concentration and effort and energy that it takes to get every corner right, mile after mile after mile. Very often, the conditions are unbelievably tricky. Take the Monte Carlo Rally, tarmac stages, but often snow and ice. And so the cars are just on tiptoes all that way. And the best drivers, they just don't make mistakes. It's unbelievable how skilled those crews are. And then there's the variety, right? In Formula One, what's the most variety in terms of the circuits? Maybe Monaco to Spa?
Monaco to Spa or Monza, yeah.
Yeah.
Or maybe someone like Malaysia.
Yeah. But they're still tarmac circuits, okay? In rallying, you've got tarmac rallies, but no two tarmac rallies are the same. You might have the Monte, which has got snow and ice. You might have Spain, which is very smooth, very wide, often very fast. Ireland's not on the calendar these days, but it has been. And those roads are so bumpy, those tarmac roads, that the teams run actually what's closer to a gravel suspension setup. And that's just tarmac. You've then got gravel, and there are no two gravel rallies that are the same. You might have mud, you might have water, like we do in Rally GB. You might have very fast, very smooth, fine gravel, like in Finland. You might have very, very rocky gravel, like Portugal or Mexico, somewhere like that. And then you've got Sweden or Norway. You've got snow and ice. And if you're going to consistently compete at the front, if you're going to win championships, you need to be as good as anybody else on all of those surfaces. And it just blows my mind that these guys are able to do that. Also, the current world championship cars, they're so fast. When you watch one come haring through a quick bit of stage, It's unbelievable. They're so much presumably faster.
Presumably, over a stage, they'd be quicker than the old Group B cars would be.
So much quicker, yeah. I mean,
so these are the quickest rallying cars that there have ever been?
Oh, absolutely. There's no question. Whether or not they're as spectacular to watch as a Group B car is a totally different matter, but they're so much faster. A lot of that is down to the aero. You can see, just looking at those cars, how much downforce they create. And you can see it. Well, often, a bit of footage will appear on Twitter or Instagram, won't it? Often it's Thierry Neuville, because he's so committed, come flying through the stage, and you just think, my God, that car is pinned to the ground. So the current cars, I think the World Championship at the moment, with at least four guys competing at the front, often more, it's in such a good place at the moment. The cars really are spectacular.
So can I ask you some, and these are just questions as they occur to me. I haven't done anything organised or write a list, but can I just ask you some questions, which to me as a sort of novice rally enthusiast, I genuinely don't know the answer to any of these. First of all, why is there no Wales Rally GB this year? And is it going to come back?
It's all COVID. You never know, do you? I hope it will come back. COVID. It's the uncertainty. You know, you think rallying is maybe the most COVID-friendly motorsport there is, because you're out in the woods. But I think it's all about being able to commit or not at a certain point to the event happening, and they couldn't.
Have other rallies been cancelled on the calendar?
I think some have. Yeah, I think they have. But the Monty, it was the shortest ever Monty this year because of COVID, and I think they had to start very, very early in the morning because there was effectively a curfew in the evening, and the crews had to be back in their hotels. So rallies are being affected still.
Okay. Pace notes. Why do they not... I sit and I watch rallying on the rare occasions that I do, and I hear the navigator reading out the pace notes, and even if I can understand what he's saying, which I rarely can, it appears to bear no relation whatever to what the car is doing or what's immediately in front of the car. So just talk us through, help me understand pace notes, so when I next see it, I'll enjoy it more. And why do they not, why can't they put up on the screen somewhere like a sort of visual representation of what the bloke's actually saying, so you can understand what you're hearing?
Well, the latter point, I guess it's because the crews all have their own systems.
Yeah.
There'll be similarities, but they all do it their own way. So you'd need to be able to interpret everything that they're saying.
You'd need to submit a script in advance, wouldn't you?
You would, and I suspect crews would be unhappy about doing that.
Sure.
Because they all have their own little tips and tricks and, little bits in their notes. I completely understand what you're saying. I'll watch a bit of footage, and the co-driver's going off like an auctioneer, and it doesn't seem to make any sense. But that's part of the mystery and the majesty of rallying, is the fact that the driver is interpreting all that and making sense of it as he's going.
So how many corners ahead is the co-driver calling? Is it literally what's coming up next, or is it, or has that, or is the driver so far ahead of the car that he's actually, already mentally filed what the next one is with the previous instruction, and he's actually asking for instructions which are like two corners down the road?
It depends on the type of stage, how many corners there are per mile, effectively. But they're quite a long way down, a long way down the road with the pace notes. So that's why it doesn't make any sense. You'll hear, three left, and the car goes round a right-hander. You just, well, what's happened there? But it's because the notes are a long way ahead of the car, because the driver needs to be able to set the car up early.
So, and three refers to the gear you should be in?
Not necessarily. It has done in the past, but all the systems are different. Some use descriptive corner, so they'll say, it'll be a medium left rather than a three left. But every crew's note system is different, and this is where Bernsey and Robert Reed, they moved the game on in this sense, because they had the most detailed notes at the time. And that was Robert Reed's great contribution to rallying, was along with Richard Burns coming up with this very, very clever system of pace notes. And Loeb did something similar, right? It's, we can get stuck into it now. As it's been explained to me, one of the limitations that Colin McRae had was that his notes would effectively tell him how quickly he could drive the car, which is fine if everything's going well for you. But if you're not happy with the setup, if you're not happy with visibility, if there's an issue with the car, you then can't go as fast as your pace notes are telling you to go. So you don't get into that rhythm. Whereas people like Burns and Loeb and others, I'm sure, they preferred a pace note system that described the road to them, that told them in very, very fine detail what was coming up.
And then so they would decide how fast that. In the circumstances that they found themselves in at the time. That is very interesting.
Which is very, very clever.
Okay, so do you require different talents to be able to drive fast on gravel or on snow or on tarmac? And do you therefore get certain drivers who are specialists? You know, on the Tour de France, don't you? You get some like sprint specialists or whatever. Mm. Do you get drivers who are really good at certain rallies and not so good at others? And if you want to be world champion, do you have to be absolutely at the top level for everything, or can you still afford to be, you know, a bit better at one type than the other?
It depends on the calendar, but you don't really have specialists these days, like not like you used to, at least. Back in the 90s, early noughties, there really were specialists. Guys like Philip Bogalski and Gilles Panizzi, these guys are real tarmac specialists, right? And some of them, they could win certain tarmac rallies because they were so good and their cars were so well suited to these events that they could win those rallies in non-WRC cars, so in the category below, in a front-wheel drive what are they called, F2 car,
so it's, yeah. So like
it's
an
got R5 much less
today,
power
yeah.
Well, it would be front wheel drive rather than four wheel drive, which an R5 is. So, but because their cars were so well suited to these events and because they were so good on tarmac, they could win, and people like Panizzi would drop in just for two rounds and win them, and they wouldn't do any other rallies that year, but they'd be in a top spec car, but because he was so good, he'd win. And then there were Finland specialists. For a long time, only Nordic drivers won Finland, and same for Sweden, same for Norway. But what happened, and I think this was the Loeb effect as much as anything, is that Loeb applied his very precise driving style to rallying. He applied a circuit driving technique to rallying, and he applied it very, very effectively. And what he did was he applied it to all surfaces. So he started driving in this very neat, very precise way on gravel. And what happened over time was that all the other drivers got, they found their way up to his level. So we're at a point now where all the best guys in the world can win on any surface, because that level, that bar, has just been raised so high that there are no more specialists. You know, there might be guys who are better suited to certain rallies, but they don't win it because actually they're no better than the best all-rounders who are just operating on an astonishing level. It is a pity, actually, because it was good fun when there were specialists, because it would mix it up. But now they're all the top guys are so good. They're as adept on snow and ice and gravel as they are tarmac.
Okay, so this happens occasionally, but when it does happen, and it's all to my understanding, it's always resolved one way. So you get these people do these features, don't they, where they put a racing driver in a rally car and then they put a rally driver in a racing car. And the rally driver always does better in the racing car than the racing driver does in the rally car. Is that because basically rally drivers are better than racing drivers?
I think it's because driving on tarmac even if you're in a single seater is more like driving on tarmac in a rally car than driving, do you get what I'm saying? I think adjusting to a new surface with all the challenges that come with it, is a far greater challenge for a circuit driver to adapt to. It's an interesting point. The thing is, nowadays, though, if you put a rally driver in a Formula One car, okay, so Loeb was actually quite close a while ago to doing a Grand Prix with Toro Rosso, and it would have been great if he'd done it, but he'd have been whooped. He'd have been whooped, just because it's not possible for anyone to jump in a Formula One car and compete at that level against guys who do it every other weekend.
Yeah, these days. There was a time when guys like Vic Elford could do that, but yeah, the world has just moved on to a completely different place in both sports.
I think all forms of motorsport have become more specific.
Yeah.
So the skill set required has become more honed, more refined, and there's, as a consequence, there's less crossover.
Okay. So a few things about the best rally drivers. So who is the best rally driver of all time? Who is the best rally driver at the moment? Who is the Stirling Moss of rally drivers? Who is the rally driver who never won the world title, but absolutely had all the talent to do so? And who is your personal favourite hero rally driver?
Sebastian Loeb is my hero rally driver. He's the one that I sort of respect and admire the most. He raised the bar higher than anybody else raised it before. I mean, his 9 world championships, all those wins, they speak for themselves.
Win the world championship?
Well, 2019. It wasn't too long ago. Otanak and Estonian won in 19. But before then, it was Petter Solberg in 03. It was quite a while. But Loeb, he changed the driving style that you have to employ to win in rallying. He turned the game on its head. He is for me the best there's been. Ogier, he's Seb 2.0. He might well match Loeb's career statistics if he sticks with it for long enough. Who's the guy who should have won? I was reflecting on this the other day, actually. Jari-Matti Latvala. He is now team principal at Toyota. He's taken over from Tommi Mäkinen. When he won, I think he was 17 years old when he first won a round of the World Championship. Isn't that extraordinary? 17 years old. It blows my mind to think about that. And at that point, we all thought, well, here's a new wonder kid, multiple world champion. Over a 17-year career that followed, I think he won 20-something rallies. So not maybe 1.5 per season, something like that. So we all thought the floodgates were going to open and this kid was going to dominate the sport. He never won a world championship. It was, and Mikko Hirvonen's the other one. He won a lot of rallies. He came second in the championships a few times. But there was a period where these two young Finnish guys were coming through and everybody thought they were going to dominate the sport between them. The trouble is they arrived in the Loeb era and Loeb redefined the driving style and those guys didn't have it.
Okay, one last question because I know we're about to time out. I want you to tell me, but you have to listen to the question first. So the question, the short question is, who is a better rally driver, Colin McRae or Richard Burns? But the long question is not who was the most talented, who could go the most sideways, which one you preferred as a person, but as an all-round, the whole picture, as a rally driver, all those things, all those different things that you have to bring to the party to be able to call yourself a world-class rally driver, as a rally driver, who was better?
I understand why you're saying that, because McRae's driving style was spectacular and he's revered because of it. He crashed a lot. I think he actually arrived in the wrong era, although he didn't, because the number of crashes he had, if you have those crashes in a Group B car, it's game over.
Yeah.
But the world rally cars that arrived in the late 90s, they required too precise a driving style that didn't suit him. He liked to fling the car around. He didn't want to feel any aero on the car. He wanted the car to move, and he was unmatched at that. Burns was better suited to these more sophisticated cars that you drive neatly, drive smoothly. He had more of a Loeb style. Didn't crash so often. He elevated pace notes to an unseen level. I understand why you asked the question, and I think as an all-rounder, probably Burns.
Wow. Very interesting. Didn't think you'd say that.
There we go. That was really interesting
in rallying. Now you've done the job.
That was good fun, wasn't it?
I've enjoyed that.
No. Okay, well, we'll have to get you out on a round of the World Championship at some point.
Look forward to it.
Have some fun spectating. All right, let's wrap that one up. Thanks, everybody, for listening or watching, if you've been watching on YouTube. I hope you've enjoyed my new backdrop. If you're watching on YouTube, subscribe to the channel. Please do. We're going to be posting way more video content. So hit that subscribe button. And if you're just listening to the audio podcast, thank you for downloading it. Again, subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Leave us a review and a rating. We'll be back again next week to do some more podcasting. By that point, there will be a new McLaren. That's quite interesting, isn't it? There'll be a new McLaren to talk about. We'll do some of that.
The Artura. We are allowed to say its name.
Yeah.
So one of those frustrating things. I know I've got all the details on that car. and they're sitting there, and I could just splurge them now. But I'd never drive another McLaren again, so I'll keep it to myself for a few more days yet.
Yeah, 7 days, we'll do it then. Thanks, everybody, for listening or for watching, and we'll talk to you again soon.
All the best.
The Drive Nation podcast with Dan Prosser and Andrew Frankel.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.